Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 5 of Topical Fever. My name is David Parsons. Thank you so much for joining in on the conversation. This week, I am talking to Justin Rogers Cooper, a good friend and fellow traveler, about the topic of climate change. This is a big one, and a topic that Justin and I have talked a lot about over the years, and one that I know forms kind of the central thrust of a lot of Justin's work in school and otherwise. And so I'm excited about getting this conversation started. I think it's important to point out, and maybe some of you have picked this up, and maybe some of you that know me in the real world or in 3D space understand how I function as a political being and political thinker, that often I start from a point of hysteria, and I especially when talking about things like climate change, I start from a point of absolute fear and hysteria. I think, you know, very apocalyptic, end of the world type notions, and I think to myself that we're caught in a in a very, very dangerous time. But then that's just the first step of the process of my thinking. The next step is I have this kind of, you know, intellectual, rational kind of way of approaching things that kicks in, that makes me think, wait a second, let's find out the facts. It can't be this bad. I have to figure out, are my hysterical notions just that? Am I just freaking out and I'm really just projecting a lot of fear and paranoia that maybe has root in a whole lot of other stuff that has nothing to do with climate change? So then I start looking into it, and I start, you know, watching documentaries and reading books and talking to friends and, you know, reading blogs and stuff like that. And what I discover, especially, you know, with something like climate change, is that my hysterical fears are somehow not even enough to describe the weight of the situation. That my hysteria actually is misguided, in that it's minuscule in light of what challenges we face. And so back to the hysteria, I suppose. So, you know, I brought Justin in because Justin's taught a lot of classes that have used climate change as a main theme. And he's someone that knows a lot about this kind of stuff. So we talked a lot about the political system in this part one that you'll hear today. Part two will be coming up next week. But in part one, we talk a lot about the intransigence of the political system and the kind of impossibility of making the kind of substantive change necessary in order to turn this ship around. And by that, I mean stop participating in and accelerating a process that the Earth is undergoing in reaction to the human activity of particularly the last 400 years of industrial capitalism. So how do you turn that ship around, particularly when the political system, and, you know, Justin and I talk a lot about the American political system because that's the one that we happen to be, you know, living under. But it's not just the American political system, obviously. We live under a kind of a global situation that's contributing to all of this. But in either case, we talk a lot about the American political system and how it seems impossible to move it enough. And we talk about Al Gore and light bulbs and the casting of this whole environmental issue as a question of individual actions, that is, you know, recycling and things like that. So we in this first episode about climate change, and again, I think this will be a continuing series, because I think this is for both Justin and I, climate change is not only the issue of our generation, but also a kind of ripe metaphor for the toll that industrial capitalism has taken upon the planet and its people, and how we can use this moment as an instructive moment to turn this thing around. So again, Justin and I have a good conversation where we touch on a lot of the political stuff in this one, and then next week you'll hear us talk a lot more about the kind of philosophical notions and larger and larger kind of almost mystical issues at play with the Earth during this very critical hour for all of us. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. I hope you join us again on Topical Fever. Without further ado, here is part one of me and Justin talking about climate change.
The reason I teach climate change classes is that, like everything else I teach, I wanted to use the classes as an excuse to educate myself on subjects that actually didn't fall in my discipline, which is I wasn't reading much about climate change in graduate school or undergraduate. And I needed these classes to help me develop a vocabulary, a discourse, a framework, a way of thinking. So I began teaching climate change probably 5 or 6 or 7 years ago at a time when I didn't know the first thing. And I probably wasn't even that effective of a teacher in many ways because I was learning it alongside the students. Or I should say I was probably an effective teacher, but I wasn't teaching from the position of an expert.
Well, I think that idea of learning along the way is something that is happening across, in a collective way across all of humanity right now. And I think that, if you're talking about, especially 6, 7, 8 years ago, climate change is something that's become a topic that's, I think, jumped from theory to reality in the last few years. Obviously, Hurricane Sandy was a big moment. Katrina were big moments, but it's been there seems to be, we use this word confluence of crises, but it seems like it's ramping up. And I don't know if that's perception or if that's real, but I think it's real. I think that the degree of storms we're seeing and the kind of catastrophes we're seeing already are an indication that climate change is not something that's far off in the future, but something that's affecting us dramatically already.
Yeah, I think it was either 2003, 2004, the French heat wave that killed 60 to 80,000 old people, mm-hmm. elderly people mm-hmm. in Europe, yep. was kind of one of those wake-up calls, followed closely by the Bangladesh floods of 2005,
yeah.
which were, flooding and catastrophic flooding associated with climate change. Then you have Hurricane Katrina, which was interesting because the narrative then was, how do we know if this hurricane mm-hmm. was caused by climate change? And that began an investigation and inquiry within the kind of scientific community represented by James Hansen, the NASA advocate for going against climate change, for controlling climate change, yeah. for warning people about climate change. He and others began to think, well, how would you know? And then there's a body of literature that's come out in the last 2 years that says, well, we don't know if any one hurricane is related to climate change, but we know that in general, the increasing frequency and strength of hurricanes is associated with climate change. So we can say with a strong degree of probability that if not Katrina, definitely Sandy, definitely probably both, are part of a wave of hurricanes that are going to increase in frequency and strength that will be associated with climate change. And so
mm-hmm. obviously the question that the media has directed it towards, unfortunately, has been whether or not this and it's framed in this kind of Fox Newsy way, is like, could climate change be caused by humans, by human activity? And that's not what I think a lot of people don't understand, is that's not under debate. That's not something that's like, oh, could it be? Yes or no? Let's see. Half the people say one thing, half the people say another. That's not true. There's a global consensus on climate change, and particularly with relation to human activity. And I think a lot of people, in other words, the right wing, and I wouldn't even say that it's the right wing specifically, but that's definitely their, the right wing is where this stuff is coming from. But at the same time, you hear a lot of liberals say this stuff too, which is repeating this myth that climate change is up for grabs. Maybe it's happening, maybe it's not, who knows? Al Gore says that, but others say the other thing. When I feel like the only people that are kind of ideologically anti the idea of climate change, and particularly human related, are people who are related to business interests that want to keep doing the human activities.
Well, I think it's
that makes sense to
yeah,
you.
It does make sense. I also think
that's oversimplifying it.
Well, no, I think it's an important strand of the conversation. Mm-hmm. I also think it's tricky with politics because, the critique of Al Gore is a solid critique. And so when the kind of people who are skeptical of climate change or just want to attack it, when they start to character assassinate Al Gore, for his ideas and start questioning his charts and presentations,
Can you explain that? What is it about Al Gore that's worthy
of criticism?
Well,
he's a hypocrite. So, yeah. For instance, the most recent example of his hypocrisy is he sold his cable news channel to Al Jazeera.
Mm-hmm. And this is current TV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he pocketed something like, 100 or $200 million personally from that. So where does the money come from? Mm-hmm. He sells to Al Jazeera, who is itself produced out of, is it the United Arab Emirates?
Mm-hmm.
It's an offshoot of a company, of a corporate, excuse me, of a country. I get those confused, I guess, in the case of the UAE.
Right.
He gets it from a state that gets its money from oil.
Mm-hmm.
So he got oil money,
right?
And there's a certain kind of irony in that.
It's not even a certain kind of irony; it's a beautiful kind of.
It's
irony.
A beautiful yeah. irony, and also Al Gore, you know, his politics are, from even from a left perspective, much in question. He was one of the main advocates for NAFTA.
Yeah.
And he's made a large personal fortune off of
his wife is very pro censorship as well. She's got kind of mm-hmm. a fascist streak about her.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not a joke.
Yeah.
She's the reason we have the parental advisory stickers.
Yep. Which are very cute. Mm-hmm. And you know, his personal narrative too, at the end of the 11th hour, Inconvenient Truth.
Right.
Two opposite films actually.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the Inconvenient Truth is similar to kind of the big problem in the liberal narration of climate change, which is here's this really dramatic planetary crisis that could end all life on the planet, if not make human civilization as we know it extinct. And here's the solution: recycling, light bulbs. It's mm-hmm. it's what we you mm-hmm. know, it's what I think a lot of people are calling greenwashing. It's yeah. the way that corporations have
locating it in consumer choices.
That's right. And individual action.
Right.
As if the answer isn't a collective petition against the current political regimes around the world mm-hmm. and demanding a different kind of political organization and a different kind of political structure and a different kind of social political infrastructure for the entire global economy, which is really, I think, what's at stake. And the reason I go back to the teaching argument, the reason I teach this stuff as an English professor from the position of a amateur, even now, is in part because I don't think that anything is more important than this subject. And I think you said that at the beginning of our conversation, there's nothing more important. And when I consider the comments and the essays that I read by James Hansen and others and compare them next to close reading a T.S. Eliot poem, mm-hmm. no, let's close read the James Hansen essay I don't think whether or not they get the wasteland at this point is anywhere near as important as whether or not they understand how CO2 is produced.
And you can still use the exploration and scholarship of literature to get to there.
Yeah, and there's literature and literary critiques that we can make that will help our thinking
absolutely.
On this issue.
And you know, when I say it's the most important issue, I mean we're talking about. I think that's what a lot of people though. A lot of when I say people, I mean the students I talk to. Often don't get that environmentalism is not about hugging a tree or something like that, but instead it's really about, and become more so in the last, I would say, 20 years, been more so about the ability of the earth to sustain human life, the ability of the earth to sustain the civilization, not only the civilization we have, but civilization period. And you know, another way to frame that, I think it's one of my favorite lecturers, Terrence McKenna, said that in a very stark way, we're committing genocide against future generations, and that the way that we have through the lifestyle that we're leading, through our kind of intransigence towards that civilization and that kind of trying to continue the level of that lifestyle is at this point truly impinging on the ability of future generations. I mean, our children and grandchildren and what their lives are going to be. So it's a really global sense, it's a monstrously selfish kind of structure that we've got set up.
Mm-hmm. And I think genocide is an interesting word to put in the conversation, because genocide assumes two things. One, you're going to prevent a culture or a group of people from reproducing according to their own desires and agency.
Right.
And two, it assumes that it's intentional.
And it's our own children we're doing that to. You know what I mean? Like you often think of genocide as being done to an other, and we often frame that racially or class-wise or whatever, but this is everyone. You know, it's certainly the wealthy will survive better than the not wealthy, but at the same time, everyone's going to be screwed by this, right?
Yeah, well, I think that's something that would provoke people to start thinking about. I think that's one of the main transgressions in thought that people must encounter, is that there are a group of people with the resources to survive most of what's going to happen conceivably, and that they don't care if everyone else does end up surviving. I think that's something that everyone needs to wrap their head around, that the people, some of the people in charge really don't care about the majority of the people on the planet. That's right. Number one, just wrap your head around that. Number two, would be that the extinction of complex human industrial, post-industrial civilization is at stake. And so the only thing to kind of take away from that is that what do you do? Yeah. How do you think about it? And the other thing I would say about genocide, though, is it is happening to people who are the others right now.
Yeah.
We don't need to invoke necessarily the children and the genocide against the children.
Right.
Because
the imaginary genocide, mm-hmm, we can talk about what's happening right now. And that's another thing about climate change is that people don't, I think that you can kind of think about it as this imaginary thing and place it as this kind of, well, what if it happens when it's actually happening already?
And there's a really great conversation taking place under the rubric of what's now called climate debt, mm-hmm, that only looks at this issue. And the main argument of the climate debt discourse is the people of the North are doing the majority of the polluting, and they're the ones that have created, in the second half of the 20th century, the social and political architecture, you know, that's founded our current global economy. Mm-hmm. As those people are in charge, and as those people do the majority of the polluting, and just think about the United States in that, the people that are suffering the first wave of climatic effects of catastrophic climate change are actually people in the global South. So, you know, people in Bolivia, for example, who are...
Yeah, you sent me an article the other day that was about I think it was about specifically Sandy hitting the poor the worst. And I think that kind of stuff became obvious to us maybe even in a visceral visual sense during Katrina, right?
Right. So Katrina and Sandy, in a domestic sense, in a urban sense, mm-hmm, exposed to us that what climate change is going to do is that it's going to exacerbate already existing inequalities, mm-hmm, and that the kinds of slow violence that is done to people of poor communities, especially people of color, that's already taking place in places like New York and New Orleans, that is A, being done on a global scale, B, will continue to be done in even worse and more extreme forms of slow and fast violence, mm-hmm, and that the only movement to arrest that kind of violence against those kinds of people is going to have to come from a new way of imagining our social and political conversations, mm-hmm, and it's not going to come from the existing order of things. The existing order of things is not going to solve the problem, and the only way in which it could, I think people would argue, is that we're going to develop a silver bullet piece of technology, mm-hmm, or an array of technologies that's going to automatically create an alternative energy infrastructure, and it's going to already
come up with a way to remove
carbon from the atmosphere.
Like wind is going to be oil,
right? And that's the whole false promise of carbon sequestration, which is that you're going to take carbon from the air or from smokestacks and pump it into the ground.
Right.
It's never been done successfully.
Yeah.
And yet that's what people still offer as a tentative solution. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it seems like we have to get over our social Darwinism at some point. We have to eradicate that. When I hear you talking about there has to be a larger shift in the kind of political conversation, it seems like we have to stop seeing poverty. And I say that because I was just reading this morning. I don't want to change the subject. I want to get back to climate change. But you know, part of this is about the impossibility of doing anything about climate change because the political system is so involved in continuing this lifestyle. And when I say that, I saw you know, Jeb Bush maybe running for president in 2016. He's getting a lot of press right now, and he said on Meet the Press this morning that that the system that Obama has created punishes successful people. And I said, really? Really, we're still having this conversation that successful people are people that run corporations? And I mean, think about how condescending that is to anyone who works anywhere. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like if you work in a factory your whole life, you're not successful. The only successful people are the people that are rich. And it's an unbelievable kind of interpolation of our politics. And what bothers me about it is that it's still there and that we're still doing it.
The discourse of success, as used by Bush and Romney, is a contemporary discourse about social Darwinism. You're right.
Yeah.
And also the last name Bush.
Yeah.
Versus the last name Clinton,
yeah,
which is probably the 2016 lineup.
It's sad. Is anyone going to notice this, that we've been in the same political families for 30 years?
I think everyone notices that. Yeah. I mean,
people like it, maybe. People like the continuity.
David, I don't think they do, because when I do my research for my blog and I put all those charts and graphs up,
yeah,
distrust in the United States government is at an all-time low. It's never been lower. The evaluation...
Lower than Watergate.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
No one
has any faith in
only between 10 and 18% of the people even trust the government a little.
Yeah.
And that's independents, Democrats, and Republicans.
Fewer than that number even vote.
Congress is at 12%. So, I mean, what's actually hopeful about those numbers, mm-hmm, is that I don't think a lot of people are missing this. And I think that when people get the full information, they understand some of the stakes involved. Yeah. And I think what's really interesting for people that are interested in politics like us mm-hmm. is that what the climate crisis is going to do mm-hmm. is produce an urgency around political change that would not necessarily exist if this was just another sclerotic political system that needed to be overthrown.
It'll bring it to your doorstep. I mean, it already is. It'll come to the doorstep of people in the Rockaways, mm-hmm. people in New Jersey. I mean, it already is at the doorstep, mm-hmm. right?
And political change and planetary crisis go together, and one is going to force the hand of the other in whatever way possible.
I mean, we saw that really starkly with the Occupy movement being really, really effective at taking care of some of the emergency supplies and healthcare and everything else. People relied on them more in areas of New York City and New Jersey. People relied on the Occupy Sandy relief effort more than they did the government, and that's a real thing. I mean, I saw that in my neighborhood. With a church in my neighborhood being basically taken over by Occupy people who just absolutely ran the show. And by ran the show, I mean they got shit done. And it was unbelievable. And we read stories about the Occupy movement basically being there before the National Guard, the National Guard showing up and asking Occupy leaders what to do and how they could help. And like that kind of weird, it felt eerie because it felt like you could see power shifting in this really profound way. So when I hear you talking about, you know, politics reacting to climate change, you can see that happening already, at least signs of it.
Absolutely. And I think that that's what sociologists who study climate stuff call social infrastructure, which is the ability of community networks to adapt to extreme situations related to climate change and to adapt successfully and effectively. Mm-hmm. And what that also points to, and I think this is also significant, is that both the left and the right, in their critiques of corporate power and their critiques of government, I think can share a sense of optimism about relief efforts like Occupy Sandy, because what Occupy Sandy suggests is, one, you know, the lack of state involvement is a product of neoliberal mm-hmm. economy, mm-hmm. a product of neoliberal government, mm-hmm. which just says small government. The only response is the private sector.
Right.
Notice the complete absence of the private sector response when there's no profit to be made, which yeah. you see in the wake of natural disasters.
Well, I mean,
at least in the immediate,
there was a cartoonish mm-hmm. moment when Mitt Romney showed up with like a box full of canned food, and he was trying to make the example that like, look, private charity is how we should do relief, and everyone, he was kind of laughed off the national stage for that kind of. I mean, part of that is just kind of his bumbling personality, but at the same time, he was trying to make a political point about that we don't need FEMA.
Well, I think there's a political point to be made there.
Yeah.
Because I think that there's a valid conversation to say that I mean this very carefully, and I want to have this as a debate. So I'm making this as almost a devil's advocate argument.
Sure, yeah.
That the kind of central government FEMA-led mm-hmm. response to natural disasters is way too centralized, A, to be effective, and B, it's corrupt.
Yeah.
And that the architecture put in place by some of the New Deal architecture that the right likes to criticize mm-hmm. is corrupt. But the answer and solution is not a dismantling of those programs.
Right.
But it's somehow I think we need to decentralize Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
And it still needs to be funded, and there needs to be an architecture, but we need a more flexible architecture. And we also, because what I don't like is, and I think the right has a point on this, I don't like people's sense of dependency on the state, so that the answer during a crisis is, where's the government? I don't think that is a completely legitimate response. I think it has to be a combination of, you know,
you don't believe that because you believe people should pull themselves up by their bootstraps and take care of themselves. You believe
I believe people should help their neighbors as human beings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's something to be said for that. And I mean, it's kind of like a cliche of the radical left of like, you know, running the system on something other than the profit motive, and you know, running it on something like you know, love or
the gift
compassion
economy
or things like that. But at the same time, there's I think it's worthy of exploration, considering the fact that having profit be the motive for most human transactions has ended us up in a accelerated moment of disaster.
And it's actually not, anthropologically speaking, the way that a lot of human societies have chosen to organize themselves
right.
for most of human history.
Right.
There have always been gift economies. And there's gift economies in operation parallel to and intertwined with capitalist economy right now in the United States.
And look how quickly that profit system destroyed the planet. I mean, if you think about, I think about a lot, because, you know, I live in New York City, and I think about, you know, these rivers, the East River and the Hudson as being like these jokes of like people won't touch them because they're filled with acid. They're so polluted. You would never. And like, you know, only a few hundred years ago, and a few hundred years is nothing in the life of the earth. This was a pristine land that you could drink that water. And like, what system is it that destroys a river that's been there for millions of years as a pristine river? What kind of system is it that can, in the flash of 200, 300 years, make that river not only undrinkable, but toxic?
Well,
toxic forever.
Yeah, absolutely. And an irony of...
Only a system that's really not profit-driven, but there's something psychological about it. It really expresses a deep hatred for not only nature, but about ourselves even. It's suicidal.
Well, okay. That's huge. I would like to sit on that. You
sorry.
Know, it's a really.
You
it's
know,
a,
when I think about the river, Justin, it really. It
I know.
Gets to
well,
me.
It's a lethal. It's a lethal point, and I think that you know that's. You know, I don't know if the suggestion of that deep psychological point is necessarily true. Although I do agree that it's symptomatic of that economic system you're describing. What I'd also say though is it's very ironic that same economic system that puts a price on everything refuses to put a price on natural destruction. Mm-hmm. So that what economists call externalities, which is the pollution mm-hmm. and the other costs associated with the profit-making system that don't get embedded into the price models that these companies make. So like, who pays the cost of the river cleanup? Who pays the cost of the plastic floating in the ocean? Who pays the cost of all the carbon production that the global south is now trying to recover?
That's all put on the public.
It's all put on the public. So that's what externalities is. It's the private corporations are...
And not often monetarily, sometimes in the form of people just getting sick.
Absolutely. And that's where the slow violence conversation starts to come in. So you get cancer from the toxins in the river, but you're paying out the medical bills. Mm-hmm. That's socialized cost. That's an externality that the company has dumped on you, the public.
A corporation killed you, and they're making you pay the bill for it.
That's absolutely correct. And yeah. Actually, in the United States, the irony there is that because the HMOs and the privatized healthcare system can take anywhere from 10 to 20% margins, meaning mm-hmm. profits, off of the sickness industry, it's not just that they're making you pay the bill for your cancer. Those treatments cost you $20,000. They only cost them $8,000. Mm. So they're making $12,000 a time, and they're returning that money to shareholders in the forms of dividends and stocks mm-hmm. so that people are actually in the United States making money off of other sick people, which is one of the reasons why when we look at Medicare and Medicaid, there is graft in that system,
right?
But it's at the measure of 3% to 5%. When you look at the privatized, when we talk about rising healthcare costs and Obamacare and all the rest, the insane part of that situation is part of the reason it costs so much is that those corporations, which are a cartel of HMOs, healthcare providers, they set the prices amongst themselves. It's a complete ripoff. It's right. It's monopoly control over the healthcare system.
And you know, to put it in a very reductive, hyperbolic, perhaps ridiculous way, it's as if they're, you know, killing your entire family and then sending you a bill for the bullets.
Right, and that's where I think people get... We don't want to think that Americans are actually responsible for killing other Americans. Mm. That is just such a horrendous thought. Even though we've had a civil war mm-hmm. and we've had all numbers of, you know, incidents of racial conflict throughout our history that really suggest that
there's so many mass shootings now. There's probably one happening right now yeah. as we speak. And I don't mean that in a trite or condescending way. When I was growing up and you grew up around the same time I did, it was a kind of the national cultural conversation about this was framed around the post office shootings. Remember that? Going postal was like a cultural, it was part of the lexicon, you know, going postal. But those mass shootings have become literally daily. And it's something that used to happen once every few years and was just this huge cultural anomaly is now something that we've written into the normal everyday course of life, is that a guy might come in the room and start shooting.
But everybody. Part of the reason why that's an effective media narrative is that we come to associate spectacular violence with the behaviors of psycho men. And I think that what we're missing by inflating and amplifying and circulating those narratives is that the real crisis and the real threat to our health and the health of everyone else on the planet is coming from organized violence that's meted out in slow, accretive ways by other groups of men who are dressed in suits, which those suits and their power is a form of immunity for them. And that we don't like to think that other people are making decisions that they know and are conscious will kill other people.
And it's very convenient to reduce that narrative to the psychopath in the school that killed 20 kids.
Exactly, which is why a for-profit corporate media would much rather focus that the psycho is among us. Mm-hmm. It's our next-door neighbor, and it's going to come out and kill our kids anytime. No. There is sociopathic behavior that's organizing violence against us and against the ecology and against the climate.
You know, one of the rare movies I've ever seen, and I don't want to turn this into a cinematic conversation, but I know you've seen this movie, and one of the rare movies that actually approaches making this kind of point about the inherent, like, the violence of the system is Michael Clayton, the George Clooney movie. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that movie?
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention that because it's rare that you see that idea of violence as I don't know, not only not the singular psycho, but as everyday, as systemic, and as so invested in our system that we don't even notice it.
Well, what it leads me to...
And we can get this back to climate change, because that's what the violence I think we're talking about here is violence. Climate change is violence.
Yep. And I also think that if we're gonna tackle climate change, it's going to take occupying the government, you know, to take the famous slogan, you know, occupy this, occupy that. We're going to have to occupy the government. Well, and I think a lot of people who are in Occupy would disagree with that. And maybe in the long term, I would too. And it's a conversation I want to have again. It's something I'm putting out there.
Can we
talk
about that solution thing at the end of it? Because you mentioned these two movies, Inconvenient Truth and 11th Hour, and you said that they were opposite. And I'm glad you're here, because I know you've shown these movies, at least 11th Hour, a million times in
classes.
And so you know what they're about. Because Inconvenient Truth, you mentioned, like, the, you know, their solution at the end of it is, like, we change our light bulbs and, like, that kind
of
stuff.
It's a consumer fantasy solution.
So what is 11th Hour suggesting? Because 11th Hour, for those who haven't seen it, is Leonardo DiCaprio produced it, and is he like, the narrator?
Yeah. And he's an interesting, guy.
It's not just Leo that's, like, the expert here. He has, like... There's another set of climate scientists.
There's an enormous amount of climate scientists and other kind of cultural theorists that are in this program. The first half of the movie is just amazing, devastating, awesome.
Yeah.
You know, they raise everything, all the issues from what I talked about before with externalities, talking about Katrina. They bring up the idea of, you know, how much value we can actually imagine can nature producing, in terms of an economic number, which... You know, 10 years ago, they put it like $35 trillion a year that nature actually produced economic value that was in excess of what the global economy was actually producing that year. But they also go into things like rights for nature. What's one of the more interesting things they think about is that one of the political solutions to climate change is actually giving rights to animals and plants, what we call rights. You know, and extending the realm of those rights, and also to strip those rights from corporations. And they even, you know, discuss things that are on the verge of conversations like corporate personhood, which is the idea that corporations have rights from the Bill of Rights, you know, from the amendments to the Constitution, and that what you really need to do is remove corporate influence from politics. Washington is a broken system. The governments in Washington, the two political parties, they both have tacitly agreed not to make radical solutions to climate change part of the agenda. The scariest things about both political parties are what they agree on, not what they disagree on.
Right.
At least in this sense. And the second half of the film, which, you know, I can't... One of the more interesting things that comes out of the second half of the film is we need to redesign our energy infrastructure. And we need to redesign our buildings. And what I prefer about that, as opposed to the light bulb, is that it goes beyond the consumer fantasy. But also that
is it kind of New Deal-ish then in what it's pursuing, like
kind of
like a giant public works project to convert the society to a more sustainable.
Yes. And it's far too optimistic. And because it came out in 2008, I think it understood Barack Obama as a civil rights figure who was going to be a magician of more significant change than he was on the climate. And the film does pull back in terms of the second half about what it imagines as a political set of solutions. I think it's, At best, it's kind of a very progressive liberalism that imagines a green economy, Van Jones style, like 2009 Barack Obama administration.
Right,
you know,
right.
It imagines a green economy being the basis of like a Marshall Plan, private public project that just would go through and like from 2008 to 2012. It understood the solution as being, we're going to retrofit all the buildings that exist. We're going to design a new car. Mm-hmm. We're going to do the solar panel thing. And we're going to, what the film actually calls for is a World War II style mobilization so that everything Full gears.
I always love that metaphor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, you know,
the only thing that can motivate us on that scale is kind of even imagining it as a war. As a war. Yeah.
And the thing is, what I agree with about that is I actually think that one of the central projects for the entire university system right now in the United States and around the world, I think one of the central projects of all education and disciplines should be addressing the climate crisis. I think we need everyone thinking about this.
And I think there should be incentives. You're not alone on that. I think a lot of people
there should be incentives to have people think about this.
And I think when I've shown climate change or documentaries that take that kind of like, and we can talk about this in another moment, is the kind of like fear-mongering angle of it, but take that kind of angle where it's like, this is happening, and there's a lot of them. And some of them are great, some of them are not. But when I show that kind of stuff, like Food Inc. is a particularly good one, and I've shown that to students, and I get, you get this attitude and you get this kind of feeling of helplessness from them, and I'm not sure what I think it's something that's mirrored in the wider culture. It's not just students that feel this way, but when they're approached with this information, they feel powerless. That's part of the system of media propaganda is to make us feel powerless. But either way, I get what they feel. They come up to me and they say, what am I supposed to do? What do I do? What do I do? What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why maybe it's comforting to hear that individual action stuff. Like, oh, I can just go get a light bulb and I can do that. And like all that stuff is great. With Food Inc. in particular, it was like they wanted to go eat organic and grass-fed beef and stuff like that. But it's like, it still doesn't really approach the kind of change that needs to happen. In other words, we can't all keep eating grass-fed beef. We can't all keep eating, even if we all become like really, really great, environmentally aware consumers, all of us have these light bulbs. It's not really going to change much, is it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that,
and I don't ask you that as a scientist. It feels like a Band-Aid.
Well, it's
that's understandable, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously hasn't worked.
Yeah.
It hasn't worked so far. We've been doing this green consciousness stuff since the 70s, right? I mean, before I was born, it's been what you choose to do on an individual basis is going to affect the planet.
Mm-hmm.
We've had that liberal narrative in action, in play for 40 years, and the solution, it can't be that. Because
the personal is political.
It's still going on. The crisis is continuing. And if you look at the ozone crisis in the 80s, what fixed it? Well, aerosol spray cans, let's take that example.
Mm-hmm.
It was legislated that those chemicals, those toxins couldn't be put in there anymore, and you couldn't do the aerosol spray stuff anymore. And that centralized decision stopped the rate of the ozone hole. Mm-hmm. So that's an example where change came from a centralized point,
right?
Made it illegal. And part of the reason why that was able to happen is that people were able to put meaningful pressure on their central governments to make changes that affected entire industries. Mm. So think about that. If you're going to keep this whole state model, like the only force of power that is going to be strong enough to stand up to companies that profit by killing, which is really, I think, that's the organized violence I'm talking about, that those state supported industries, the food industry, the oil companies, et cetera, the corporations that are basically saying, for us, the risk of planetary crisis is worth it in the short term because of all these incentives that we're going to get from continuing the system in the short term.
And the shock doctrine stuff too.
That's right. If you take all that and then you have a state that's supporting that, and then if you say the only thing that can stand up to them is the state, well, there is a model for that in terms of the ozone stuff, which was also an international treaty, that came out of that stuff. Meaning international cooperation, a cooperation of states. We're making that happen. Okay, so then occupy the state. And then the question is, how do you put meaningful pressure on the state? But all of those so-called solutions are political, not falling into the realm of consumer choice.
Right. Well, what about this? I mean, to locate it in consumer choice a little bit more politically is like the economic boycott, the idea of like vote with your dollars instead of, in other words, withholding purchase of items that are destructive. What do you say to people that think that that's a good approach to reducing our footprint?
Well, I've seen economic boycotts work on a local level during the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
What is the precedent for an economic boycott working in the second half of the 20th or the first third of the 21st century?
Mm-hmm.
What's the precedent? And I'm probably missing something. Does anything come to your mind?
No. And I'm thinking about, like, you know, sitting here with, computers, for example, that, computers are made with minerals that are mined.
Conflict minerals.
Right.
In Congo.
Right.
With child soldiers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, apart from even just the human tragedy that is, and if you've seen videos of children, like, rooting with their bloody fingernails mm-hmm. into the dirt to try to get minerals that they can sell to people with guns, you understand on a very visceral level the human cost of that. But even if you look at, you know, helicopter shots of these places where they're mining these minerals mm-hmm. out of to make your cell phone and your computer mm-hmm. and your iPad and your whatever, voting with your dollars seems really trite at that point. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Because the level of this is much larger than just like, oh, I'm not going to buy a computer, so Apple will go bankrupt and they mm-hmm. won't do that anymore. I think on a grand scale, I can imagine something like that working, but it would have to be much, much more. I mean, I feel like when I think about stuff like that, it always gets me to the same point, which is that everybody has to change. Like mm-hmm. everybody has to change. It has to be a much deeper kind of cultural
but
revolution.
But change can be forced into the vanguard. So a couple things. One, there is a divestment movement from South Africa in the mm-hmm. 1980s that really was effective in bringing down the South African government
yeah.
in 1989. Mm-hmm. Two, you know, abolitionism and the civil rights movement in the United States are two movements that were led and spearheaded by a group of very socially conscious people that spread a message and were able to win over a majority of mm-hmm, the population. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in terms of everybody having to change within the realm of politics, we just need a majority to occupy the government. We need a majority of people to figure this stuff out and put leaders who think the same way as the people in positions of leadership where they can accomplish great things.
And it's, I mean, the civil rights movement and abolition are great examples because, you know, you can see political change happening and then you can try and figure out how did it happen. You know what I mean? In a certain sense, especially the civil rights movement succeeded by putting the issue right in people's faces and communicating it. I mean, you have I think of that in two ways. Like one is the actual words that Martin Luther King as a deliverer of this information becomes to white liberal America. I think that's where you kind of have to locate the at least the cultural change, or at least one part of it, an attitudinal change or something like that. But there's also, you know, the civil disobedience that actually brought the kind of bodily abuse into people's homes through the television. I mean, there's a lot of complicated stuff going on there.
Well, I think but
it's about communicating.
Yeah, it's about communication. It's about storytelling, which mm-hmm. is really important. A lot of the people that critique people that are obsessed with collapse and like the doomers, what they're really upset with them for, in part, is they're only telling one kind of story about the future.
Right.
And that's a story that disables collective action now.
Yeah.
And no matter what you might think deep down about the chances or probabilities of success for this collective action, mm-hmm. I believe, and I stand with the people that believe, that if you choose to just narrate the future as a place that you can't change, I just don't think that is an ethical or moral story to tell.
In other words, like apocalypticism as an ideology is a defeatist narrative.
It is defeatist.
Right.
And it disables our students. Yeah.
I think it's fun for people. And I think that's maybe, and when I say fun, I mean people like to imagine the end of the world. I'm obviously not the first person to point mm-hmm. that out, that our culture is kind of obsessed with it.
Well,
and living in New York City, and this isn't even like a post 9/11 thing. New York City has been cinematically just destroyed over and over and over and over again. And it's something that almost feels like some sort of teleology, like a collective death wish mm-hmm. that is fun for people to imagine.
And I think for other people, what's fun to imagine, and for people that are kind of confused progressives, maybe like myself, you know, is mm-hmm. that imagining the end of this system is somewhat joyful because you want to see the end of the kind of organized violence that I was describing earlier.
Or you just hate the system. You just hate, I mean, you and you don't even realize it.
And you're
kind of
wishing for a power strong enough to bring it down. The problem is, you know, I don't want to go down with the ship.
Right.
I want to change the person who's helping to create direction for the ship.
One of the authors that I read a lot early on in my kind of development about thinking about climate change and planetary crisis is Daniel Pinchbeck, and he had an article about the blackout in 2003 in New York, and I remember him kind of describing the tone of the city, of a somewhat joyful tone, that there was a party atmosphere to it. And he described that as he felt that it was an expression of a kind of collective malaise and a collective, like, people hate this system. And when the lights go out, they're like, yes, like, I don't have to work anymore. The computers are down and I can be human. And it was I remember that, thinking that was a kind of a profound thing to think about, that there is that apocalypticism itself is kind of a fantasy of capitalism ending and a fantasy of living a different kind of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, even if it's you know, walking around an empty Manhattan with your dog and vampires everywhere, like, you know, I Am Legend or something like that. It's like, well, at least that would be something different. You
I
know,
think I think what it taps
than
into
the
is
kind
that,
of drudgery of my
yeah,
life.
Yeah, exactly, and exactly. And so,
in
exactly.
other words, what you're calling like organized violence, I think a lot of people don't perceive it that system is that. In other words, you might express this as, or you might think this is selfish, but a lot of people just think of it as, you know, my life sucks, my job sucks, I don't want to do this anymore, I hate getting up every morning and going into an office or going into the construction site or whatever. I wish I'd it lived a different life.
Well, I think a lot of people do.
I don't like renting my entire That's life right. out.
Exactly.
So that I can eat.
I don't like renting my labor.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we're at a moment with all the distrust in the government, and also with 1 out of 7 American adults on food stamps, 1 out of 4 American children on food stamps, you know, with dependency on the government because the corporate state has not provided them answers.
Mm-hmm.
As people, you know, get older and, you know, and experience some of the exploitation that we're talking about, I think that all of us start to oversimplify the solution, which is this apocalyptic narrative that something's going to come and wipe it all away and give us another chance. And I think what people really want out of their lives is respect and dignity and meaningful social relationships and meaningful work. People don't mind working.
Mm-hmm.
They want release from the work that what you call the drudgery.
Right.
And we can achieve
the lack
lives.
Of the lack of a spiritual connection to their
that's
work,
right.
And that's I mean I just mean that in a really simple way. I mean, feeling that their work matters in some way,
mm-hmm.
Beyond just like making someone else rich.
That's right, and I really think the majority of people feel that way. And I think that there is a self-selection process where the people who don't feel that way are able to rise up in certain situations and, you know, get in positions where they're able to commit this kind of organized violence. But this is part of what the conversation about climate change should be about, because I really think. And this goes back to your students. I really think that the time is quickly approaching when we have to start to sort out the complex conversations that are possible to have around, for instance, the future of business. Because I've thought about this for a long time, and I think meaningful work is really important. I think there's always has been an economy. There might have always been a form of the market economy. But this kind of economy that we have is a product of the 18th and 19th century, in which all the accumulation of all of the wealth and value that's produced by everyone is organized in a way to end up in the hands of very few people, who then distort systems of democracy, mm-hmm. in which technically people should all have a say on certain situations, certain matters, and so the system becomes skewed. I think when you talk to your business students about things like bottled water and,
right.
and things like that, you know, we've had debates in the past about the ethics of business, and those were debates about slavery. We've had debates about the ethics of business in the past, and those were about segregation and lunch counters, et cetera.
And child labor.
That's right.
And
child labor.
You know, equal pay for equal work.
And women yeah. going into the
right,
workforce.
Right.
We've had debates before that were complex, substantive discussions where we said, you know, this form of business is unethical. But
we've even had about in about the environment. Nixon was the guy that was doing the more environmental regulation than any other president ever.
That's right.
Right. And so we've had this conversation already. And this brings me back to something that we thought about last time when we were kind of in our more adventurous thinking mode, when we were talking about slavery. But the idea that, you know, I just did the Gilded Age this week in my class. So I thought a lot about the industrial capitalism really taking off after the Civil War and the costs being immediately evident, right? Like that's the cliche historical narrative of the Gilded Age, is that immediately you have millions of immigrants living in tenements and slums in the Lower East Side of New York City, living in absolute squalor and filth. And the system immediately produced and displayed how ugly it was and how intent it was on enslaving the people of the earth and destroying the earth itself. And that in a certain respect, and I say this maybe as a devil's advocate thing, but I wanted to get your response to this because I've been thinking about it a lot, is that, you know, the story we tell ourselves about American history is that there's been periods of reform of that system, right? And so you get progressivism coming out of that era and leading to, you know, the no child labor and leading to even early environmental regulations. And then you get the New Deal that has all of it was response to crisis. But at the same time, there's the idea that that regulatory impulse that we call, that we now call liberalism, is the only institutional structure that we've created that has even attempted to restrain the impulses of a system that's intent on enslaving us all and killing the whole planet. And that also kind of indicates how handcuffed we are because of how effective liberalism is against that system. Does that make sense to you? That narrative?
Yeah. So I think
is liberalism, can it be converted to meet this crisis, or is liberalism, has it constantly proved to be ineffective in?
Well, by definition, I don't think liberalism can meet this crisis without radical change.
Mm-hmm.
And that the reason I believe that is because liberalism, by definition, says keep a free market economy and then give people social safety nets for the inequalities and the really the worst forms of exploitation that are going to come out of that. So if you look at the social security system, which is food stamps, Medicare, Medicaid, what liberals will already admit to you is in a free market economy, as a, you know, laissez-faire capitalism is going to produce homelessness, poverty, sick people, dying people, and starving people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what laissez-faire capitalism produces. Yeah. So in order to keep the productive benefits of capitalism, which is to say enormous technological and rapid technological change, et cetera, all those things that liberals like to associate with capitalism, which mm-hmm. is technological change. Those two go together, and liberals have a very hard time in their minds untwining, say, the production of television and media change and the internet and energy systems. They have a really hard time disentangling technological innovation from capitalism, even
right.
though
mm-hmm.
we have human history that goes back before, say, 1750, in which you had technological change, including, I mean, language, fire. I mean, start at the beginning.
Yeah.
We've had technological change throughout human systems.
Without the profit motive.
Without the profit motive yeah. for the majority of our history. So
yeah, but liberals love to talk about the profit motive, though, as
the only thing that incentivizes right. people to work.
Right.
So,
and if we carefully regulate that, then we can check the greedier impulses of it and run this thing forever.
So that's what we understand liberalism to be, like, in a political sense.
We can
sense.
Run this thing forever.
Yeah, and the thing is, the thing can't be run forever. And so here's what the kind of liberal reformists would admit right now. Right now, we need a wholesale reconstruction of the energy infrastructure of the entire planet. Okay, that's what a liberal, like, green liberal, let's say, would say that.
Right.
We need to get off fossil fuels. What's happening? Fracking.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening? Keystone.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening? The United States has discovered cheap oil.
That's the thing, is even the liberal reformist that you're talking about, the green capitalist or the, you know, the green liberal, they're not even getting anywhere close to their vision acted out by this administration.
And the green capital people are going to say we need to continue with the current economy with less carbon pollution.
Uh-huh.
So what's been happening? You know, and there are people that say the alternative energy infrastructure and grid already exists. It just needs to be phased in. I would ask your listeners to educate me on this, because I want to know, like, is the only thing holding us back is, like, solar panel construction?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right.
Really, we just need to build a million windmills?
Yes.
Is that really it?
And we can have iPods and iPhones.
I don't quite buy it. And the only thing that does is address carbon production. It doesn't address all the other forms of slow violence that you know, such as mass species extinction.
So I mean, we have almost 8 billion people on the earth now, right? And something like 7 billion,
at least seven going on eight, I think.
You know, that number is an expression of fossil fuel, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what is that? I mean, what is that uncomfortable reality? What I'm getting at is that can the Earth sustain a population that large without industrial capitalism? Or, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, here's there's two ways from that. One,
or when industrial capitalism goes away, does the population go back to the 1 to 2 billion that it was for 20,000
years? This is the
years?
1972 limits to growth argument,
yeah, right.
which said, you know, the what we need is a system that grows slower,
mm-hmm.
and that it's already grown too much. And all, a lot of people say overpopulation is the big problem.
Right.
Too many people producing too much waste. To which the greening liberal, I guess, who would say we need an alternative energy infrastructure would say, actually, you know, we have plenty of solutions to this problem. And it doesn't matter how many people there are. What matters is the waste they produce. And if you can get them to produce a different kind of waste, you're going to get a different kind of climate.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if all of those people are bent on consuming the same kinds of resources that, you know, the United States consumes in the current energy context, know that the planet can't sustain it. And then someone else would come back and say, and these are the peak oil people, no, because liquid nitrogen, which is one of the main byproducts of the fossil fuel economy, is itself responsible for 3/4 of the fertilizer that goes into mass agribusiness. We can't actually feed 8 billion people on organic farms.
Mm.
I don't know if that's true.
Mm.
You know, in other words, you know, if you could go back to 1800 when in the United States, what was it? 75 to 93% of the entire U.S. population were farmers on organic farms.
Yeah.
If you took the cash crops out of the situation, so, which means we're not going to produce cotton, tobacco, and all that other kind of stuff on the same scale that we are now. Mm-hmm. We're not going to use this land to produce corn that's going to go into ethanol for fuel. We're going to take the land that we have and we're going to grow organic food. And a lot of people, instead of going to work at an office, are going to help, you know, rake,
yeah,
or whatever,
right.
You know, this
yeah,
is kind of
right.
weird fantasy.
Yeah.
It's the back to the land thing.
Could you feed the world? It's Jefferson, though.
Yeah, and I'm kind of thinking, well,
it's kind of weird that the history of our country, it has this kind of it's a false dichotomy in U.S. history, but at the same time, it has something to it of like the Jeffersonian versus Hamiltonian vision of what the country was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to see that kind of like archetypally playing out now.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of like capitalism versus farming.
Mm-hmm.
but at the same time, it's an expression of the idea that we've gotten away from what the real purpose mm-hmm. of life is,
and there were people that say back to me and have said back to me, okay, that's not a good fantasy, that back to the land thing, because the most environmentally responsible for people to live is in cities.
Mm-hmm.
So that the urbanization process that we associate with industrial and post-industrial capitalism was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
It provided, I mean, accidentally, maybe it provided an urban architecture, which is actually much more energy disintensive than suburban or rural kinds of living patterns, and that we're never going to go back. You know, the cities are here to stay, and that we need to kind of change the carbon pollution that's emitted, you know, in those cities, but also everywhere else. And my question to them would be, okay, then, you know, once we get off fossil fuels for the sake of the global climate, what is the input, fertilizer input, besides nitrogen, for the agribusiness that's only now represented by 1 to 3% of the population and is controlled by huge corporations?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then who's feeding the cities?
Yeah.
And I want to have the rest of that conversation, because I'm sure the person would have a good answer to that, but I want to have the rest of that conversation.
So pretend I'm the student that just listened to this and is now feeling helpless, you know, and feeling like that they're trapped in a system that they can't do anything about.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't want to ask you what can you do, because we've already talked about the individual action being unfortunately how this is being framed. But what do we do? What do we do about this? I mean, and when I say what do? I mean, I don't want to get into the apocalypticism, but at the same time, there is a kind of sense that we're the word is tipping point, right? And can you explain what that means? Because you sent me a great video about permafrost and the permafrost tipping point. But there's this idea that we reach a point where it doesn't even matter if we do anything about it.
Yeah. Okay. So I hear two questions there. One is, what is tipping points? And two, what do you tell the student?
Yeah.
Number one, the tipping point is, at a certain point, we've put so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that the climate starts a feedback loop that goes off on its own. And no matter how much pollution you cut, or how much you try to do,
or how many light bulbs you change.
The climate's out of control. And yeah. So what I understand that to be is, after you hit 1.5 degrees Celsius, and right now we've increased the carbon parts per million in the atmosphere, like 0.8 degrees Celsius. We're going to hit 1.5 degrees Celsius probably by 2030, 2040. Mm. And the amount of carbon we've already put in the atmosphere is going to get us there, which means we actually need to stop polluting now in order to kind of leave off these effects. So one of the ways that we just think about the tipping point is at a certain point, once the planet has passed this amount of carbon in the atmosphere, it'll go into a runaway cycle of warming that nothing can stop. So once you start thinking about that, you start looking at the different things that could push us past the tipping point. Mm-hmm. And when you bring up permafrost, this is what's a part of a really interesting set of discussions that's come out of last year. There are two additional sources of carbon that are coming into the atmosphere that add to the human production of carbon in the atmosphere in ways that would not necessarily be part of the regular geological carbon cycle. Number one is the permafrost, which is as the frozen dirt, which is what permafrost is, in places like northern Canada, the Arctic, and in Russia, as they melt because of global surface temperatures rising associated with global warming, as they melt, if they come into contact with oxygen, they're going to produce carbon. And if they don't come into contact with oxygen, they're going to produce methane. Methane is a greenhouse gas. Carbon dioxide is obviously a greenhouse gas. They're going to go up in the atmosphere. And as this frozen dirt becomes warm and comes into contact with oxygen or not, it's going to unlock a treasure chest, bad word, of carbon that's been kind of in this soil,
a Pandora's box,
for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands.
I mean, and yes. It basically, like, and it begins to stack up. It accelerates the process, yes. I think it's not only beyond our human control, which I think is what is indicated by the word tipping point, or at least how I understood it. But it also means that the process itself becomes self-replicating to exactly. a level that, like dominoes, you know,
exactly.
And dominoes maybe is the wrong metaphor, actually, if there are any physicists out there. But either way, it's the idea that once it starts falling, it falls at a much faster rate.
Yes, and rises at a more faster rate.
Mm-hmm. So we're at that moment.
And the other source is coming from the ocean.
We could be at that moment. Yeah. And scientists now are foreseeing that moment coming up much faster than they had before.
Yeah, everything that we talk about having to change has to change within 10, 20 years, period. After 20 years, if business as usual... Like
we are the ones we've been waiting for.
That's right.
To borrow a phrase
and from... And not him. He is from, not the one we were
Obama's
waiting for.
Administration. He's
not the one we were waiting for. And the other source, just for the record, of the tipping point is the same process is happening on the floor of the ocean. Mm. And what we didn't understand is that the ocean has been absorbing vast tons of carbon dioxide that we thought was going to the atmosphere. It's being absorbed by the water. That's raising the acid levels in the ocean, what's called ocean acidification. Mm-hmm. That's what's killing all the lobsters off the coast of Maine. That's what's helping to kill them, in addition to rising ocean temperatures. And as the temperature of the ocean rises, the same kind of release of methane and carbon from the ocean floor is also taking place. So those are two additional sources of potentially catastrophic carbon that's going to be put in the atmosphere alongside the smokestacks. Here's what I'd say to the student. Number one, there are historical precedents for change on a global scale. Mm-hmm. The most important one was the specific kind of slavery we call Western slavery that rose up in like 1490 mm-hmm. and, you know, shat itself forward,
yes.
pardon my French, yes. until about 1880 in Brazil. And for the person who says, yeah, but, and this is me, you know, for the person who says abolitionism didn't work, it took a civil war, well, fine. Two conversations to have around that. One, the British in 1807 got rid of their own slavery
right.
in 1807 without that kind of level of civil violence.
And that's the time the slave trade stopped, mm-hmm, right, in the United States. That was the first step towards
abusive
system.
And two, concurrent with the American Civil Rights Movement was the global decolonization movement.
Mm-hmm.
Global movements that changed everything. And they're global.
Yeah.
And we have a precedence, and our parents participated in them, and our great-great-grandparents participated in them. We have an immediate history to draw upon and lessons from that immediate history, and there are so many smart people. So that number one is the kind of planetary change that's needed is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the whole rise of the local food movement, which comes with its own inherent set of problems, mm-hmm. you know, and that's another show.
Artisanal mustaches is probably mm-hmm. the...
actually
one of those problems. But either way,
what I like about the local food movement, though, you know, and there's a lot of things to dislike, and there's a lot of things to like. One of the things I like, though, is that it's a model for local economies. Mm-hmm. And you know, go to the farmer's market, and you're talking to the person who you know grew this thing. What if you applied that localism back into manufacturing? So, in other words, part of what increases carbon production is the so-called, you know, the food miles, you know. Mm-hmm. But what if you applied that same mileage to your computer, your laptop? And what if we started a movement that told Apple computers, I want to see on the label how much carbon was produced in the making of this product, the same way that I want to see that, you know, on my food.
So it is, yeah, it is pushing capitalism, but in a much more engaged kind of way.
Right.
And I'm glad you brought up the local food thing, because it, you know, we talk about individual action, but at the same time, it does matter.
It does matter.
I don't want to sit here and be like, well, you should just, you know, not care about any of your consumer
Absolutely not.
Decisions, because those things are important and
incredibly
and,
important.
And the food, the organic food movement and the local food movement especially, are another place that, you know, and I engage in this myself sometimes, but another place that's often parodied and marginalized in our culture and associated with this kind of hipster or hippie or kind of label. And I bring this up because I hear a lot of liberals, and I've heard a lot of liberals in conversations say that really express a lot of disdain for the hippie thing. And the local food movement is from hippies, 100%. I mean, the organic movement is something that developed out of the counterculture of the 1960s and 1970s, and has been, you know, splintered off to a million different directions, from farmers markets to, you know, the giant corporation that is Whole Foods. But either way, that's a legacy of a kind of counterculture that's consistently marginalized in our culture. And I feel like that marginalization, that kind of constant mention of like, oh, I'm not a hippie, or I don't like that hippie element, or look at that stupid hippie, is just a shorthand way of stereotyping culture or a counterculture that's developing alternatives, trying at least to develop alternative practices to a system that's destroying things. And so when I hear liberals say, oh, hippie this or hippie that, I'm like, the hippies are some of the only people in the United States that are organizing things like local food movements to actually address some of this stuff. I think it's the liberal just says, the liberal has government regulation. In other words, the liberal is looking to the state, whereas the right. whereas the quote unquote hippie is looking to themselves or each other. And I don't want to be like,
and that's a cool thing to actually have a conversation with a libertarian about that.
Yeah,
because that's the point that I was trying to make earlier about FEMA and the rest and Occupy Sandy.
Uh-huh.
And part of what I want to say back to you and your Baruch students is, and this goes back to the business conversation, what you're describing is an alternative market economy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, those restaurants that serve all the local food, they're still making profit, so mm-hmm. to speak. In mm-hmm. other words, I don't want to ever come across to anyone in these conversations as being, for instance, against forms of small business.
Yeah.
And when you have,
in a sense, that has to be where we go.
That's right. And I think
think that becomes clear. And I don't want to lay out like a whole, like, you know, structured vision of what you and I would agree on a lot of things of like how we would envision a future culture, but it would definitely be a lot more local.
And everything would be more local.
Yeah.
And I also think that,
in other words, the profit, whatever profit is being made, stays in the community with the people that are making it.
Yep. And when you have your students in business, and the biggest intellectual mistake that they can make is to conflate all forms of business practices together.
Right.
And the biggest intellectual mistake that they
Walmart
can make
is the farmer's market.
Is to think that they have to defend the practices of corporations, because if they don't, they're against all forms of market economy and business.
It's like, well, I want to run a business.
That's right.
I mean, Alec Baldwin said this at Occupy Wall Street. It's like, I would never want to get in the way of someone, you know, inventing the next Apple computer. And he has this kind of
stupid fallacy.
Yeah, it's really stupid.
We need to take that apart at a future show.
And you know, in my hometown in Ventura, California, they're trying to bring a Walmart, and there are a lot of people that want a Walmart as a solution to the employment problem in our town. Like, well, if we have a Walmart, then there'll be more people working. And I thought, God, what a terrible situation to be in. But at the same time, Walmart is a perfect example of that kind of the anti-local, because Walmart doesn't have any interest in my hometown. They're just there to extract wealth from people and extract wealth in an incredibly aggressive manner. I mean, really, because they're extracting wealth in a way that lowers the ability of people to make money and make decent money and decent wages is
incredibly destructive.
There are people in my community in Crown Heights, though, that want Walmart to come into Brooklyn.
Right.
That want Crown, because they
don't... It's an example of how handcuffed we are by the system, right?
Well, no, because they're working class African Americans and people of color that want Walmart. And
that's what I'm saying. That's what the handcuff is that you end up wanting that.
Well,
in your
I want to just... But here's the reason why.
Yeah.
They don't want it for jobs.
Yeah.
They want it because they're getting price gouged by small business people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the interesting conversation, is that the small business model that we're advocating as a alternative to the kinds of corporate globalization that are affecting the environment, they're not the panacea either. But what's interesting is that part of the reason why those small businesses are price gouging is because they have a local monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think that people want the box stores to come in is for the lower prices, because it would provide competition with these small businesses.
Right.
Well, I think what people really want, and I could be wrong, is they just want competition and they want the best price. And I think that there are ways to imagine a market economy that's intertwined with a gift economy, and that, you know, if the small business person was putting the needs of their community first, or equally with their own personal desire for accumulating wealth,
mm-hmm.
I think then you could have a different kind of conversation about whether or not the big box store is necessary to come in and lower the prices.
Right. Because
I think what people really want is to have a meaningful relationship with businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, for the students, you know, businesses don't have to be cold-hearted, accumulative, distant, foreign bodies that acquire wealth through incremental purchases and sales, and then accrete that wealth into a centralized location to return it to shareholders. We can think of marketing. We can think of small business practices as becoming more locally responsible, more locally engaged, and sharing in the daily and ordinary life of the people that business is intertwined with and around.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the beginning of a conversation about local business practices, that, you know, if people could pass localized legislation that said, you know, one of the ways that we're going to admit this business, and people in San Francisco have done this, one of the reasons why we're going to choose to admit this business into our community is because we think that the operation of this business is going to have a beneficial effect on the lives of the people in it.
Mm-hmm. And that conversion has to happen on a massive scale.
And it can be a kind of, you know, we can start to have a really interesting, fruitful conversation.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
And we can have the conversation at Baruch.
Yeah.
But we have to get everyone disentangled from the idea that centralized corporations and centralized governments are the only people who are going to be in charge of our future.
Right. The only administrators of the human project.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I knew that this climate change topic would be huge. Justin, I know you've spent so much time thinking about climate change that we're going to have to come back, because I think that, you know, the conversation goes in so many directions when you think about this, because really the climate change conversation is really just a more immediate way of having a larger conversation about the systems that run the world and where we are.
Well, it's an honor to be here, and I didn't even get to talk through most of my notes. So
we
have to have another show on this at some point in the future. And I really appreciate your time and for organizing this.
Well, you know, climate change part two will be coming down the pike as soon as we can put it together. So thanks for coming, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you so much.